was living happily on the land with all the other animals. Powwows every day. And then one day, a chief, code for fair-skinned, religion and disease-spreading, egotistical dick who actually got his weapons and technologies from shorter brown people living to his east, came to build his house on Raven's land.
Oh, where have we heard this before?
Then the chief builds his house, and he steals the sun from the sky, and he keeps the sun inside of a box inside of his lodge, kind of screwing over all the natives that were living on the land before he got there.
Oh, this sounds like a local story. No, I heard this happened to my cousin.
In the end, the raven sneaks into the house, he steals the sun, and he throws it back up in the sky. Now the kicker is, while the raven's in the chief's house, he impregnates the chief's daughter. So the moral of this story is very simple. When you build your house on natives' land, eventually you will...
All right, we'll just bleep that last part out, okay? Use your imaginations.
Bueno, lo estábamos escuchando a Yellowfly. Y ahora, como se han dado cuenta, este programa ha estado basado en la música, jazz, blues y la comedia. Y nuestro último entrevistado fue Eric Wilson, quien se estará presentando el 29 de mayo con un stand-up comedy en el Rest Café del 920 de Commercial Drive. ¿Sí? Además, esto va a ser con fines de benéficos para su viaje tribal de este año que se va a realizar. Así que no se lo pierdan, anótenlo en sus agendas, 29 de mayo en Rest Café del 920 de Commercial Drive. Ahí estará Eric Wilson.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much for translating. No. It's been a fun show, you know? Wasn't that fun?
Yeah,
little twists and little turns. Yeah. We got to hear a little bit of Cree, and we got to hear some great music by Murray Porter and Farrah Palmer, and then we got to tickle our funny bones with Eric Wilson and, of course, Dallas Yellowfly. Uh-huh. Yeah. The listeners might remember him from previous shows, and now you got to hear him again. Okay, thank you so much for joining us on Language to Language. I understand you are taking off soon,
I'm taking off for 2 weeks, so see you at the end of the month of May. Enjoy the summer, and Gunarji will have to wait for some rain, but everybody is expecting
everybody
some sun.
Everybody else should be good. All right, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so, Kalanwi.
Oh, Good afternoon. This is Marco with AstroTalk, your astronomy talk show on CITR Radio. Last time, I talked about the history of astronomy, and we wrote a new we wrote a supernova in from the Andromeda Galaxy. This supernova exploded 2 million years ago, and we wrote it in to explain the history of astronomy on our planet. So today, I'm going to continue where I left off with talking about somebody named Chandrasekhar. Chandrasekhar was an astronomer, and in 1930, Chandrasekhar, who was from India, was 19. He was boarding a boat on his way to London. He was about to begin his master's and PhD study in astronomy under the world's most prominent astronomer, Arthur Eddington. On the way to London on his boat cruise, Chandrasekhar figured out the properties of black holes. At that time, in 1930, Einstein had already formulated his theories of relativity, and also he did in 1907 his Nobel Prize-winning work on the photoelectric effect. At that time, nobody knew about black holes or neutron stars. So on the voyage from India to London, Chandrasekhar figured out something called the Chandrasekhar limit. It was the mass beyond which a star would become a neutron star, and later another limit was established that if a star had a mass beyond this limit, it would become a black hole at the end of its life cycle. Now, when Chandrasekhar arrived in London, his professor, Arthur Eddington, everything Chandrasekhar proposed went against the beliefs of Eddington. So when Chandrasekhar presented his PhD thesis, Eddington automatically stood up and ripped his thesis apart. Since Eddington was the leading astronomer of the day, people tended to believe what Eddington was saying. So many other prominent physicists, they had never theorized about black holes. They didn't know what a black hole was. So at that time, in the mid-1930s, the issue of black holes died. And it wasn't resurrected again until 30 years later. So one man, Arthur Eddington, because what Chandrasekhar proposed went against his beliefs, he destroyed the notions of black holes. So the Chandrasekhar limit was an important thing, and it was the mass above which the electrons can no longer counter the pressure in the star's core to balance the gravitational self-attraction of the star. So now I'm going to be talking about, after this introduction to Chandrasekhar, I'm going to be talking about things like neutron stars and supernovas. But to begin this discussion, oddly enough, I'm going to start it with talking about the Empire State Building. So that's really quite odd that when I'm talking about black holes, I'm going to begin the program talking about the Empire State Building. And the reason I'm doing this is when I was watching a documentary on the Empire State Building, somebody asked a question, and the question was, if all the atoms, all the electrons, all the neutrons and protons that make up the matter in this Empire State Building, if it was squished together, how big would that be? The answer was, the Empire State Building could be squished down to a small grain of rice. So that is what matter tries to do. Matter, through its own gravitational self-attraction, tries to squish itself to a point, and this is what happens in a black hole. Now, in the 1930s, when Chandrasekhar came up with his theories of black holes and how massive stars could squish themselves to a point, nobody had heard of black hole, nobody theorized black holes, so it wasn't as in our culture today, everybody seems to know about black holes and everybody seems to accept the notion that black holes exist. So it wasn't until the 1960s when the scientists at Bell Laboratories, they picked up noises from the sky and they thought these were extraterrestrial beings trying to communicate with us. So there was a fairly regular pulse that they could pick up from various areas of the sky. So they termed this pulse LGM, which means little green men. But they later discovered that these pulses were the spinning of a neutron star. So neutron stars, they spin. Some of them spin 1,000 times a second. Some of them spin one time a second. So they spin at a fairly regular pulse. So it was in the 1960s that scientists started to receive proof that neutron stars did exist. So today this is the first show that I'm going to be talking about things like neutron stars and black holes, things I call death stars. And a death star is something that could threaten the existence of our planet. So before I begin talking about neutron stars, I'm going to first have a discussion or an introduction on what a star is. A star begins from a molecular cloud in any particular galaxies. So stars are formed in giant molecular clouds. In the Milky Way, for example, an example of a molecular cloud would be the Orion Nebula in the constellation Orion. Now, nebula is a Latin word for cloud. So that's what exists in large parts of our galaxies, large molecular clouds of hydrogen and helium. And as I discussed earlier, matter attracts other matter. So in large stars, for example, in stars that eventually become black holes, the matter is trying to squish itself to a point. So when our star forms, or when bigger stars form, they form from these large molecular clouds. And scientists believe that when a supernova erupts and the pressure wave hits one of these molecular clouds, this starts the collapse of the cloud. So all the matter in the cloud collapses in on itself, and if the mass is enough, all the matter in the cloud will form a star. So there's things called brown dwarfs, and one of them was discovered close to our solar system recently. That's about 7 light years away. And what brown dwarfs are failed stars. So there wasn't enough mass in the molecular cloud during the collapse to initiate nuclear fusion. So fusion is when things like hydrogen forms with another hydrogen to make helium. So it's when new elements are made in thermonuclear reactions. It's different than fission, where on Earth we have fission reactors which split atoms. So in stars like our sun, there are fusion reactions. So what happens in a star like our sun or bigger stars is there is enough mass in the star to start nuclear fusion in the star. So all the atoms in the molecular cloud start falling in on each other. They attract each other. And this creates a lot of pressure and heat in the middle of this large cloud. And this is what happened to our sun. The pressure and the heat, they increase until there's a temperature reached about 10 million degrees Celsius, where nuclear fusion begins. So in our sun, in its core, 600 million tons of hydrogen is fused every second. And an equilibrium is reached where the nuclear fusion reactions counter the gravitational attraction of all the matter in the collapsing star. So in our star, we have a stable star where the mass in the whole star is trying to squish everything to a point. But then in the core of the star, this increases the pressure, increases the temperature, and then nuclear fusion begins. So in our star right now, a lot of hydrogen is being fused into helium. So fused means the molecules are being fused together in the nucleus, and they're creating a new element, helium. It's called the proton-proton cycle. There's four stages in it. So our star is not big enough to become a black hole. There is not enough mass, and there's not enough mass even to make it a neutron star. But the bigger stars, for example, there's a star called Betelgeuse in the Orion constellation. It has maybe 20 times the mass of the sun, and scientists predict one day it will explode into a supernova, and in our sky we will be able to see it because it will be as bright as the moon. So these are the stars that I'm going to be talking about, stars with great enough mass to go beyond the hydrogen fusion phase, and which eventually become supernovas. This is Marco on CITR. We will pause now for a station break.
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants!
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this.
Welcome back. This is Marco on CITR. You're with AstroTalk. I was talking about stars, neutron stars, black holes, and maybe how stars become neutron stars and black holes. So our star will not have enough mass to become a neutron star or a black hole, so it will not go into the supernova phase. It will basically fizzle out as a white dwarf. First it'll become a red giant, and then it'll end its life as a red dwarf. So now I'm going to be talking about stars that I guess I call them death stars, that could threaten the existence of life on our planet. So in a way, before I go on to these neutron stars or black holes, the sun in a way is a death star because there's no life on Venus, there's no life on Mercury, and Mars also does not have an atmosphere, so the sun makes it so there's life is not possible on those planets. And within 1 billion years, the sun is growing in temperature and in size now. Within 1 billion years, all of the water on our Earth will be evaporated out of our Earth because the sun is becoming hotter and bigger, so life will not be possible in 1 billion years. So in one way, the sun is a death star, but I'm going to be talking more about the neutron stars and the black holes that could threaten the existence of our planet right now. So right now I'm going to be focusing on neutron stars, and in particular, one type of neutron star called a magnetar. So before I go on to talk about the magnetar, I have to give a bit, like a brief introduction into the Greek letters alpha, beta, gamma. So in science, alpha and beta and gamma could mean a lot of things, but in astronomy, it could mean the designations of stars in a constellation. But in nuclear reactions, the alpha is a helium nucleus without its electrons, so it's an ionized helium nucleus. The beta particle there's two things that a beta particle could be. It could be a beta minus, which is an electron, or a beta plus, which is a positron. Now the gamma, it's not a particle, it's a ray. And it's the gamma rays that are produced in things like neutron stars and magnetars and black holes that are especially damaging to human beings. If the Earth is hit with a high enough dose of gamma rays, it could ionize our atoms and it could break the carbon bonds in our amino acids. So it could threaten our life. So gamma rays are very high energy rays. They have very short wavelengths, and X-rays are also very high energy rays. So now I'm going to be discussing this thing called a magnetar. So what is a magnetar? A magnetar is a type of a neutron star with a very powerful magnetic field. Magnetars, as of this time, are the most magnetic things in the universe. So, for example, if a magnetar was close enough to Earth, it could disrupt the electron clouds in our atoms, which means we would all die, or it could strip all the magnetic information off our credit cards. So I don't know which is worse. We couldn't shop or we die. Maybe both are the same for some people. But anyway, so now a magnetar is a very powerful neutron star with a extremely powerful magnetic field. So neutron stars form after a supernova explosion when the original star, it was fusing hydrogen in its core. Now our sun does not have enough mass to initiate helium fusion in the main sequence phase, but a neutron star or a star that will eventually become a black hole, they do have enough mass. So in a star that will eventually become a neutron star, when the hydrogen is fused in the core and is all turned into helium, the star begins to contract because there is no more nuclear energy to counteract the gravitational self-attraction of all the mass in the star. So when the gravitational attraction becomes stronger and starts squeezing the core stronger, then the temperature rises enough so that helium fusion can begin. So then this is a shorter phase, and the helium will fuse into either oxygen or carbon. So after that happens, the shell just outside of the core, it begins to fuse hydrogen. So then you have in the core, the core is fusing helium, and in the shell just outside of the core, it's fusing hydrogen into helium. So when the core is finished fusing helium into carbon or oxygen, it starts to contract again. When all the helium isn't used up, the pressure, it increases, and it becomes hot enough to fuse other elements. So this process keeps going on, and subsequent shells are being formed outside of the core until in the core they reach where silicon and neon and magnesium are fused, and then what's left in the core is iron. Now, in the previous fusion phases, the fusion process released heat and energy, and this heat and energy counteracted the gravitational attraction that is trying to squeeze all the mass of the star to a point. So what happens is there's an equilibrium reached where the star keeps producing energy, but the gravity keeps trying to squish the star to a point, all the mass in the star to a point. But when the iron phase is reached, iron cannot be fused and release energy. Iron needs energy to fuse. So when the core becomes iron, the core, which was producing energy, now needs energy. So there is nothing to hold up the gravitational attraction of all the mass in the star. So this core, which was several tens of thousand kilometers across, instantaneously implodes. Within a fraction of a second, the core falls into the center, and when it hits the center, a lot of the matter rebounds out. And this is called a supernova explosion. So supernovas can release, in a matter of seconds, as much energy as is released in the lifetime of our star. So these are fantastic events, and if a supernova explosion occurred close enough to Earth, then it could threaten the existence of life on our planet. So again, I'm going to refer back to the Chandrasekhar limit. If what is left in the core is above 1.4 solar masses, then there is not enough mass to squish all the matter in this remaining core to a point. So the electrons get squished into the nucleus of the atoms, and this produces a neutron star. So a neutron star is maybe 12 miles in diameter, so maybe from UBC to SFU, but a teaspoonful of the matter would weigh about 100 million tons. So neutron stars are very massive objects, and they mark the death of a star whose mass remaining in the core was 1.4 solar masses. So in one of 10 neutron stars, the conditions are right enough to create, instead of a neutron star, you have a magnetar. Now, magnetar is a neutron star with a extremely powerful magnetic field. The magnetic field in a magnetar is a million, 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 million times as strong as the magnetic field in the Earth. So this itself could threaten the existence of life on our planet. This is Marco. You're listening to CTR. We are going to go to a station break.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to the Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow. It sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
Welcome back. This is CITR Radio. You're listening to Marco on AstroTalk. Now, today, this is the first in a series of programs on things I've called Death Stars. So Death Stars can threaten the existence of life on our planet. So, for example, the Sun regularly, solar flares and coronal mass ejections erupt on the surface of the Sun, and these could be dangerous to life on Earth. But things like magnetars and black holes, they can be much more dangerous and they have much more power. Okay, so we were talking about the magnetar. The magnetar is a type of neutron star with an extremely powerful magnetic field. If a magnetar was close enough to our Earth, just the magnetic field itself could disrupt the molecules in our body, making life impossible. So the theory of magnetars was first produced in 1992. But before that, scientists were puzzled by many things that eventually were theorized to come from magnetars. So in 1979, a Soviet spacecraft was surveying the Venetian atmosphere in Venus, and it dropped off a few probes. And on its way back, it was hit by a burst of magnetic radiation. So in a matter of a few microseconds, the radiation of gamma rays spiked 200,000 times. These were recorded later on Earth and on other space probes in our solar system. So this was as yet the most powerful blast of radiation coming from outside of the solar system. So again, the reason that magnetars can threaten life is their magnetic field. So any planet in the vicinity of a magnetar would probably, life would cease to exist first from the supernova explosion, but also the magnetic field, so the very powerful magnetic field. So magnetars are extremely powerful magnetic fields, and they are different than ordinary neutron stars in that neutron stars have a weaker magnetic field, but they spin sometimes as fast as 1,000 times a second. So magnetars usually spin anywhere from 7.5, their period is 7.5 seconds to 10 seconds. So it spins in one revolution will take 10 seconds. So this is how scientists can tell the difference between something. This is one way scientists can tell the difference between a neutron star, which is an ordinary neutron star, and a magnetar. So magnetars, the danger they pose to life on Earth is that their extremely strong magnetic fields often decay, and this produces jets of radiation spouting out of their axes. So these are either gamma rays or X-rays, and this in 1979, this was the first proof that something, that radiation of radiation coming from a magnetar. Prior to this, scientists were thinking that some of the gamma rays coming from these objects came from pairs of neutron stars that would collide or explode, or one neutron star would siphon gas off a nearby neutron star and produce an explosion. So it wasn't until recently that scientists discovered magnetars. So the strong magnetic fields of the neutron stars themselves can cause problems, but there's another thing about a magnetar that is dangerous to life on Earth, and that is something called a starquake. So starquakes are, I guess, similar to earthquakes, but much more powerful. So in a starquake on a magnetar, what happens is the fluid under the core, it is in motion and it shifts the crust a bit, just like on our Earth where the plates move and causes a powerful earthquake. But in a magnetar, the starquake is much more powerful. So in a magnetar, in 1/1000th of a second, in the first magnetar recorded, the energy released was equivalent to the amount of energy our sun would give off in 100,000 years. So when magnetars either decay, their magnetic fields decay, or when starquakes appear on the magnetars, then this is when the gamma rays are produced. So again, gamma rays are very short, are electromagnetic radiation of very short wavelength, and light is electromagnetic radiation of much longer wavelength, and the longest electromagnetic radiation are radio waves, and they're harmless because they float around in our atmosphere and constantly come in and out of our body. So these are very long wavelengths. They have no lethal effects on our body, but gamma rays do. So when the magnetar, either the magnetic field decays, or when there is a stark wake on the surface of the magnetar, then the gamma rays and the X-rays are produced. Before probably 10 years, 15 years before, when scientists only had regular telescopes to view the cosmos, there was no way to measure this kind of radiation. But now we're in our golden age of astronomy, where there's X-ray telescopes and telescopes that can see in the infrared, and they could see these gamma rays. So it is these gamma rays that come from the neutron stars or the magnetars that make the magnetar a death star. There are other types of gamma ray bursts from black holes, and these are called long gamma ray bursts. And from the magnetars, the type of gamma ray bursts are called short gamma ray bursts. So these magnetars are lethal in that their magnetic fields are very strong, and just the magnetic fields could disrupt the molecules in our bodies, making life impossible. But also it is the stark wakes which produce the bursts of gamma rays. And in one stark wake that was measured on December 27, 2004, a burst of gamma rays passed through our solar system. It came from a magnetar that was named SGR-1806-20. Now, this is a cluster of stars that is 50,000 light years from our Earth. So on December 27, 2004, the burst of gamma rays, which left SGR-1806-20 15,000 years ago, entered our solar system. So SGR-1806-20 is 50,000 light years away from Earth. It is part of a big cluster of stars. There's some hypergiants. Hypergiants are very, very massive giant stars and other giant stars. So as of November 13th, 2013, 21 magnetars are known in our galaxy. But scientists estimate there are roughly 30 million magnetars in the Milky Way that have decayed to the point they are not dangerous anymore. So a magnetar's life is usually about 10,000 years. So the harmful effect of the magnetar ends 10,000 years after it is formed. So here's a list of some magnetars. The first one I mentioned was SGR-1806-20, located 50,000 light years from Earth on the far side of our Milky Way. It's designated SGR because it's in the constellation of Sagittarius. Another one, SGR-1900+14, is 20,000 light years away from Earth in the constellation Aquila. A burst from this magnetar was detected on Earth on August 27, 1998, and it was sufficient power to force the near shutdown of a spaceship called Shoemaker. Had to be shut down to prevent damage to its instrument, and the NASA's Spitzer telescope discovered a ring of matter around this magnetar. The ring of matter was thought to form in the 1998 burst. Another magnetar from SGR-051, or from the constellation Sagittarius, SGR-0501+4516. These are long designations, and astronomers, it means something to astronomers, so I guess that's why they have these long names, but I'm not sure how to explain these now. but another magnetar was discovered on August 22, 2008. These magnetars are very far from Earth. For example, SGR 1900 plus 14 is 20,000 light years from Earth, and SGR 1806-20 is 50,000 light years from Earth. So these are too far away to cause any damage to life on Earth. But a magnetar that was closer would cause damage. Another magnetar that was discovered, SWIFT J1822-3, was discovered on 14 July 2011. This had a lower magnetic field than the other magnetars, so it was not as threatening as the other magnetar. The largest recorded starquake of a magnetar occurred on December 27, 2004 in SGR 1806-20. It released gamma rays equivalent to 10 to the 36 kilowatt in intensity. So this occurred 50,000 light years away. If this had occurred 10 light years away from Earth, this could have triggered a mass extinction on the planet Earth. Mass extinction. So today was the first discussion in a series of discussion on Death Stars. Just recently, scientists have been able to discuss these things and do experiments because of the invention of things like X-ray telescopes and observatories that can pick up gamma rays. So the discussion started with Subramanian Chandrasekhar, a 19-year-old from India, who in 1930 proposed the existence of a star that could squish itself out of existence. We now know these things as black holes. So our sun does not have enough mass to become a black hole, but in the constellation Orion, the star Betelgeuse is close to supernova phase. Giant stars like Betelgeuse or stars that become magnetars, they have a lot more mass than our star, so than our sun. So it would be logical to think that these stars would have a much longer lifetime than our star, the sun. But stars that are very massive burn their fuel in a matter of millions of years. So Betelgeuse is now about 10 million years old, and it's predicted to go supernova quite soon. It could be a million years, or it could be tomorrow. And since Betelgeuse is 500 light years away, it could have already gone supernova. So we will not know until the light reaches us from Betelgeuse. So what started in 1930 with a theory proposed by Chandrasekhar is now accepted in our culture that black holes and neutron stars exist. And these are dangerous stars which could threaten the existence of life on our planet.